Hello, and welcome to the Nerds Now Playing podcast, where we talk about all things nerdy, including video games, movies, and entertainment. This is recorded in the Feely Creative podcast studio in Salina, Kansas. I'm Tim, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Devin. Devin, how are you today?
I'm doing very well.
Excellent. That was... There's something about the way you said that that sounded like a character to me. But in addition to that, today is kind of a signature day. We have our first guest. Hello, Amber.
Hi, guys.
Hi, Amber. How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good.
Yeah. So, Amber, who are you and what do you do for a living?
Oh, man. I also work here at Feely Creative, but I'm an editor, as Tim is, mm-hmm. and we make cool stuff.
Yes, we do. By the way, today is as March 24th. It is National Cheesecake Day. And it's also National Cocktail Day.
Ooh.
So.
What a combo.
Right? So after work or during work, you go and get yourself a cheesesteak, and maybe some cheesecake later on.
Oh, cheesesteak.
Yes. Cheesesteak, as in like a Philly cheesesteak.
I thought you said cheesecake too.
That's its own
also,
national holiday.
Also, what a combo. Both of those are like really good combos, I feel like.
Well, like cheesecake and a cocktail, I feel like. Cheesesteak and cheesecake sounds like it doesn't, like it's not a good combo.
Sounds like a
way.
Rounded meal.
Maybe so. but we should probably get into today's mini topic. Today, we are talking about the film, or we will be talking about the film Perfect Blue, which is an anime film. And so I thought it would be good to go through, first of all, what is your guys' favorite anime? Do you have one?
Oh, man. My favorite animated thing is probably Howl's Moving Castle. Hands down, one of my favorite animated films.
I am a fan of Studio Ghibli or Ghibli. I've heard both pronunciations.
Yeah.
My favorite's probably Princess Mononoke, if we're going strictly Ghibli here. Mm-hmm. Or Nausicaa Valley of the Wind. Those are very neck and neck for me. Although Nausicaa is technically pre-Ghibli.
Yeah.
It's like right before. It's Miyazaki's film before that.
Well, Amber, I haven't heard of the movie you mentioned. What is that about? What is going on with that one?
Howl's Moving Castle is great. It's about a girl who meets this magical prince. They're in a land where it's warring and he has the powers to pretty much stop it. But he hides in his moving castle so people can't necessarily find him. And then she kind of pries him out of the darkness and makes him fight back.
It's interesting. Do you prefer the subbed or dubbed version?
I've watched both. If I'm just like watching it for like background noise, because I do that, I'll put it on repeat like a million times. I'll leave it on the dubbed version just so I can kind of hear what's going on. But
makes sense. Yeah. It's just interesting because like once it was released in the States, then whatever studio actually released it or did it here, they got some big name actors for that. The only one that comes to mind is Christian Bale.
Yeah,
because he's the one who voices Hal. Is it Hal? Is it actual name?
His Moving Castle,
I figured it was. It's been so long since I've actually watched that one. Uh-huh. And he does a weird, like, Batman-esque voice.
Yeah.
At some point
strange.
In the film.
But, like, he doesn't talk as much as, like, you would expect him to. And then when you do hear his voice, it's like, whoa. Mm-hmm.
And that's a Studio Ghibli film?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so it's, like, my favorite is Princess Mononoke, which is probably the first. Well, actually, it's not the first one I saw. I think the first one of theirs I watched was Kiki's Delivery Service.
Mm. Yeah. Yep.
Which... that one's really good. I didn't actually get into those until college because it wasn't part of my upbringing. Like I didn't have access to those, and I didn't know about them. So there was actually the Salina Symphony when we were at Wesleyan. They did a Ghibli concert or like an anime concert.
Oh, that's fun.
And they had like stills and images from the movies, and so like I was at that one. I think we were working it for Paul. Mm-hmm. And I was just kind of enchanted by the music.
Yeah.
And that one. Awesome. So it got me into it. And
you guys are talking about Studio Ghibli. I've seen a couple of those films, but it's been a while. So it's I think the one though that you mentioned Kiki's Delivery Service.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That one does stand out to me as one that I kind of liked.
Liked
a lot. Yeah.
Right. The cats are so cute.
They are.
I like that story of the Kiki because she's a young witch in that and so it's I like the story these stories where they like when a young youth tried to discover their place in the world and they're figuring it out and she's a witch and so there's that whole dynamic. I thought it was a really cute film. Probably the one I watched the most recently, and it's been at least 5 years since I watched a Studio Ghibli film, so. But that one always stuck out to me. And I've seen like Spirited Away and a couple of others.
I know that one is probably considered to be his like best.
Yeah.
By most fans. I need to rewatch a lot of them. I've definitely seen that one and it is fantastic. Like, No Face is a really interesting character. But yeah, there's a lot that are out there that are great. There's several that I still haven't watched. I still haven't watched Porco Rosso, which is like it's like a pig man that like flies an airplane.
Mm-hmm. And that's a movie as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The weirdest one I've ever seen is Pompoko.
Oh.
it is another kind of a, I don't think a lot of people have watched it, or maybe they have, but Pompoko is kind of a, the story is mainly taking place with these raccoons. It's like den of raccoons that have magical abilities to enlarge parts of their body. That's all I'm going to say on that.
Interesting.
And it kind of is like they, at some point they try and like there's like construction coming in near where their home is. Mm-hmm. So they try and like fight back humanity to like keep their stuff theirs.
That's cool.
And it's very, very weird. but like if you want a really good, like I know My Neighbor Totoro is a really good one.
Yeah.
I'm a fan. Yeah. That one I think is definitely more for kids.
Yeah.
It has that feeling, but it's adorable. I really love Ponyo. Have you seen Ponyo?
I haven't.
Oh, Ponyo. So Ponyo is basically The Little Mermaid. Like it's Miyazaki's version of The Little Mermaid.
Mm. Oh, cool.
But instead of it being like a romantic love story, it is more from an unconditional like, friend love.
Right.
Because the main characters are kids.
That's cool.
And I actually prefer that much more than like love at first sight stuff. So that one is really adorable.
So how would you describe Studio Ghibli films compared to like other studio houses that make animated film? Is there something that sticks out?
There's a lot of magic involved.
There definitely is.
Yeah, it's not a lot of real life situation.
I would say one of the main like defining features is that I believe almost every single one, if not every single one, features a like strong female protagonist. Mm-hmm. Like that's a main feature for Miyazaki, and it's not something that you unfortunately see in a lot of films, especially like animated films and ones that like are even more for kids. Cause even the ones that are more kid oriented have like a stronger female lead. And I think that's important. Uh-huh. There's like a lot of times you see like the young prince who's has to go save the girl. And like, it's nice to see that difference. I'd say that's a defining feature.
Mm-hmm.
And also just the animation style itself.
Yeah. I've like, Princess Mononoke I have seen too. And, I really like the animation style. It's very like colorful and fluid, and it's every frame is like really beautiful. Mm-hmm. And that movie too has a strong female protagonist, I remember. Mm-hmm. So, which is, that was something I didn't really think about until you mentioned it, but that's very much the case, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is for most of them. I mean, and granted, like Princess Mononoke does technically follow Ashitaka, who is male, but like Mononoke herself, she's a central focus, if not necessarily the main protagonist. But I mean, it's just like one of the leads is always a strong female character. So
do you have a Studio Ghibli film that you might recommend for somebody who's not quite familiar with that work?
I mean, I will always recommend Princess Mononoke, but know that it is not really for kids, because there are moments of limbs getting chopped off.
Yeah.
And other things like that. I highly recommend that one. That one is also like, it is a kind of like a save the forest kind of thing.
Yeah.
I'm enchanted by the design of a lot of the background characters, like the Kodamas, the little like tree spirits.
Mm-hmm.
I actually have a friend of mine made me a small like terrarium type thing.
Oh, that's so cool.
With a Kodama in it.
Mm-hmm.
So I highly recommend that one. I recommend Nausicaa. Yeah. Valley of the Wind, I think that one's fantastic as well, even though it's technically pre-Ghibli. If there's one that I think everyone should watch, is Grave of the Fireflies. It is so depressing sad. As hell. I mean, at least watch it. If nothing else, watch it once, because it just it really sheds a light on how destructive dropping the bomb on Hiroshima was.
Oh, it's so sad.
And during just the whole war and everything.
That one, now that you mentioned it, I have seen that one, and that one did stand out to me. It was very dramatic, and like in the what you mentioned, that situation that town is put in was really intense. Like, that was a great film.
And I mean, it destroys you entirely. But it's an experience that, like, if you haven't seen it, I think you should. Like, it's definitely not one that like kids would not understand what's happening.
Yeah,
most likely. So it's not one I would recommend for that. But
If you want to watch one of your kids, you should watch Howl's Moving Castle.
That is a great one. That's a great choice.
It's excellent.
Totoro and Ponyo are also good kids ones specifically. I think Kiki could be as well.
I pulled up Grave of the Fireflies, and that is 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah.
It should be.
I'm not surprised.
It's well done. It just destroys. But I'm curious. So in talking about anime, do either of you remember the first anime you saw? Or like the first one you invested time into?
Oh, man. Does Teen Titans count? Like the original.
I don't know if I'd consider that anime.
Yeah. Okay.
Maybe. Well, I mean, I haven't watched the original Teen Titans.
Then the one got like the first like really in-depth invested into was probably Death Note.
That's fair.
Yeah.
I really like Death Note.
Yeah.
Devin, have you seen it?
No, I have not seen Death
Note. So Death Note is, the main thing about it is that this guy basically finds the Death Note, which is a book that are held by the Shinigami, which are basically like angels of death.
Yeah.
That's the best way to put it. So like it falls from their realm and he picks it up. And like it has instructions in it of basically, if you write down the name of somebody and how they will die, then they will die
in that way. Right.
And so it focuses on the main character, Light Yagami, I believe is the main character. And he finds this, and the Shinigami also starts Ryuk starts following him around and kind of like telling him what to do and all this kind of stuff. And he decides
to kill bad people.
Yeah. Like the society deems as like bad people, but he becomes a murderer himself, but he's constantly pursued by M. Is it
L?
Thank you.
One of the letters.
Yeah.
Something in the alphabet.
This guy who's like a super cool detective. He's trying to catch whoever's like mysteriously killing all of these people.
It's a really interesting anime. I mean, it's very dark.
Yeah.
and it's one of those like, without really spoiling anything, it takes a turn. Like it's only got two seasons.
Yeah.
And like
it's fast.
Between like
it's so fast.
Seasons one and two, like there's a major shift and like one that I didn't know how it was going to pan out because I'm like, how is this even going to work? And it's just so well done.
Yeah,
I love Death Note.
It's very good.
Does Death Note have one show of it, or is there other versions of it?
There's the main anime, and then there is a
live action
adaptation on Netflix.
Yeah, well, that
in
was
which,
bad. It's just really bad.
I could only stand the first 15 minutes of that one.
It's pretty cringy.
The one that has in its favor is that, what is his name? Willem Dafoe voices Ryuk, which is a really interesting choice. I could get behind that as a performance.
But the execution just
Is it bad though? Because what makes it bad? Is it just not faithful to the source material, or is it something else going on?
I think the main problem is that like there are certain things that just work better when animated than live action.
You can't make a live action like Ryuk look good. It's just so hard.
It just looks different. It'd be like...
it's like trying to capture the holy essence of a death angel in a real human being. And that's just not...
It looks weirder in live action than it does as an anime. Uh-huh. It's kind of like the Dragon Ball Evolution movie. That movie is absolute garbage.
It is.
And the characters don't look good.
Right.
Well, they tried to...
There's a whitewash.
They try to like one-to-one like the look. Like anime, those characters have like certain design elements, their eyes and the motions, the way they emote and their hair, hair designs. But you can't just copy an anime's hair style to real life.
Natural in real life. No.
And that's the same way with Ryuk. You can probably Google a picture of Ryuk and just have a full understanding of why trying to make that human just didn't work.
Yeah. It just doesn't look.
Well, and he has like, doesn't that character have like really angular facial design structures to it. So
and
I could see how that would be.
So it's like...
Oh, he's actually like scale-wise, he's huge?
Yeah, he's
supposed to be huge.
Yeah, the Shinigami are massive.
Right.
So yeah, that one doesn't work. I haven't watched a lot of the other or even really tried. I know they recently did a Cowboy Bebop live-action show.
That one was actually
pretty heard is decent.
Yeah.
I do like Cowboy Bebop. It's one of like the most highly recommended anime out there. I'm a fan. As far as like the first show I ever saw... was Baccano. Are you familiar at all? So I did pull up the what the actual description is, because it's been a while since I've watched it. So it focuses on various people, including alchemists, thieves, thugs, mafia type people, and they're all unconnected to one another. until after an immortality elixir is recreated in the 1930s in Manhattan, the characters begin to cross paths, setting off events that spiral further and further out of control. And there's some really, there's just, the characters in it are really interesting. And it's one of those, like, one of the things that I love about anime is that they have really iconic openings. Mm-hmm. And like opening themes, and that one has a very like jazzy opening theme. Yeah. And like, I'm a huge fan of jazz.
Yeah.
And it's just fun, and it looks well, it looks great. So like, that was the first one I can remember watching, and that's because my friends in high school, who are really the only friends from that time period that I still talk to quite often because they're my gaming group.
Hmm.
They got me into anime, and so we sat at my house, like in my basement, and we watched Baccano. Wow. And that started us watching even more, like watching even more with them. So like, that one's a really good one. Devin, what about you? What was the first one you saw?
Well, I think like a lot of young males like me, my first introduction to anime was probably Dragon Ball Z on Toonami. And I might have watched something anime before that, but I think that was the one that I actually like was super invested in. Because a lot of my friends were as well, so we would always draw the characters.
Nice.
We would always be in class drawing like Vegeta or Goku or anything. But that show, like, I just thought it was a really good show. But they was also a very frustrating one to watch.
All the filler.
The filler and the episode, like the credits will roll at the 20-minute mark. But in those 20 minutes, they break it up with some commercials and stuff too. But that show was one that. At the very least you could say they did it well or did it poorly, but they had cliffhangers on every episode that like really made you want to like see what's happening on the next exciting episode of Dragon Ball Z.
Yeah.
And so that one was one that got me hooked and started with anime, I think, in the first place, because those characters of Goku, Vegeta, Piccolo, Gohan, like something about like these fighting characters that have the power level is that they have to measure how much more powerful one is to the other. I mean, it gets a little bit, and the power level doesn't matter as the show kind of goes on too much.
After the Frieza saga, the power levels just, they don't mean anything.
But I liked it at the beginning because like, okay, Goku has this power level of like 1,000 and apparently it's a big deal on Earth to be at 1,000, but then someone comes, Raditz, his brother comes, and that's how the show starts. And but Raditz has, I don't know, power level of more than that.
Not much.
And but it's a big deal to Goku and Piccolo, who and I hadn't seen Dragon Ball Z is the sequel series to Dragon Ball, and I hadn't seen Dragon Ball at all until much later. So I knew that these characters had some kind of backstory or relationships, which I thought was interesting, but I never. I don't think Cartoon Network played Dragon Ball
probably not
like ever. Mm-hmm. So and I had to seek that out in a different way later.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have seen Dragon Ball too, but Dragon Ball Z is probably what got me first started because all my friends were really into it. We liked the fighting, the battles that they had, and those power levels that I mentioned. Like every new enemy had this little bit higher power level, and it was always like every new revelation of that was like, oh my god, he's the most powerful person. How are they going to beat him?
Well, especially when Goku first reaches Super Saiyan during the Frieza saga. And that's a huge defining moment.
And so, in just a little bit about Dragon Ball Z, so they're on Earth and they're called the Z Fighters, and it's made up of a couple of the main characters, and they in Dragon Ball they would fight in tournaments and something, and it's always about martial arts and training and stuff. And when I was in high school, I wasn't in conditioning classes myself, but Dragon Ball Z was a huge motivator for a lot of the people in my class, my friends and others, to work out and stuff.
Oh, interesting.
So that was like the show to get that got everybody pumped to work out and stuff, because in that show, that's Goku's so always training, and he's like trying to get to the next power level, and that usually involves a lot of testosterone and muscles and stuff. And so my friends and stuff, that's when we're like doing bicep curls and all that stuff, and we're trying to get muscular and stuff because of this stupid show.
So did you work out to the Dragon Ball Z theme that was in the US, the dragon Rock the Dragon.
I did not, but
is that it on your playlist now?
That show, also, he's adding it today.
That, right. You should.
That show was on my mind whenever we hit the weights or not. But that show was just really fun with how every new enemy was this powerful force, yeah. and they had to like band together and mm-hmm. fight it. But that show was really known for these. Sometimes frustrating cliffhangers because that show was on Cartoon Network,
yeah.
and they only had so many mm-hmm. with English dubs mm-hmm. yeah. available to watch. And so we would get to the point in the series where the big bad or whoever they're fighting against, they have this climactic battle. Mm-hmm. And right before that starts or concludes, you know, and this is in high school, so I'd run home from high school after school mm-hmm. to park myself in front of the TV and make sure I was Cartoon Network was on. But then you get to that where the show starts and they don't have any more English dubbed episodes to continue. Yeah. So then they would revert back yeah. to like when Raditz first lands on the planet mm-hmm. Earth.
Right.
So the very beginning of the show. And then you're just like, your 14-year-old self is like crushed because you dealt with a whole day of school to just run home and watch the show.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have any new episodes for, I don't know, 6-8 months.
Yeah.
And that was
streaming
so
has spoiled
hard.
Everybody.
It really is.
Yeah.
But you'll find out next time on Dragon Ball Z. I'm a fan of Dragon Ball. I didn't get into it till probably after college.
Yeah.
Like I knew of its existence, but I didn't have Toonami growing up, so I didn't really get into it. And thankfully, I was told to start watching Kai instead of Z because it cuts out all the filler.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't do with all the filler. It just,
you
it
like
was
the episode where Goku and Piccolo go drive cars?
Yeah, mm-hmm. But some of those episodes were just like 20 minutes of them just screaming. And
that was the worst. So the characters in there, they power up and it involves these long, drawn out
and it's just 20
screaming.
Minutes of screaming.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, this is not interesting as a kid. So I just shut it off.
You didn't try and go Super Saiyan?
No.
I do think that is probably the worst filler because I think the manga was only written to a certain point.
Yeah, I think it was only like a couple pages of that.
And right. then the show was catching up to it too right. quickly, so they had to do
they're
these
like, slow it down,
filler
make
episodes.
Scream longer.
So I can just imagine. So who wrote Dragon Ball Z, the manga? I can't think of his name. But I'm imagining him just at his desk every day.
Just writing it out, yeah.
He's writing as fast as Goku can train.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's going to make me like, I know in the back of my mind who wrote it, but now I can't think of it. But I will say, so like, as far as other animes go, like you mentioned Death Note, like I love Death Note. Mm-hmm. Soul Eater is one of my favorites.
Oh man. Okay.
I love
so
Soul
like
Eater.
I have a history of naming animals after
I was gonna say,
characters.
One of yours is named after the main character in Soul Eater, Maka.
Yeah. Maka is my dog.
Yeah.
And I had a cat named Ryuk. So.
Oh nice. Yeah.
I'm bad about this, I guess. So.
Oh, explain that show a little bit. I have not seen it.
So it takes place from what I remember at like, is it Death Academy?
Yeah.
Technically.
Yeah.
So the main characters are basically like Reapers. Mm-hmm. That go after like bad spirits.
Yeah.
And so one of them is the actual like training one. Well, I guess they're both training.
Yeah.
So one of them is a living weapon as
yes.
well. And so there's always two students that are paired together. So Maka has hers, which
soul.
Turns into a scythe.
Yeah.
Soul. And there's another one that, and so they're basically going around trying to capture these bad souls. And after they capture so many.
Yeah, they like their powers get increased and
yes.
they get like more in tune with each other.
That's
so
right.
like she's more capable of using mm-hmm. soul.
That's what it is.
And there's like just like partnered off groups that are like kind of competing to get mm-hmm. like their soul bond to be the best.
And then yeah, Death himself is like the
yeah.
Academy Master, and he has a
yep.
much different design
oh, yeah.
than you would expect for Reaper. And he's like, he's super happy all the
right,
time.
Right. This is all like cutesy animated stuff.
Yeah.
This isn't like serious like Death Note where it's like realistically animated. This is all like borderline like chibi animated.
Yeah, that's a fair assessment.
Right.
It's not like soup. I mean,
right.
Not all of the time.
Yes.
But yeah, yep. I would agree. Like
yep.
like Death himself
right.
is very much kind of that
and it's
light.
So funny because it's like super cheery and then something bad happens and like the sun will turn to like bloody
yeah.
or the moon will start like running blood out of its
mm-hmm.
mouth. Like
yikes.
It's wild.
It's very stylistic.
Yeah.
I will
it's
say like
so cool.
I love that show, but I also like, I don't know how you feel about it. I hate one of the characters in that show. Can you guess which one?
Is it Black Star?
It is Black Star. I hate Black
yeah.
Star.
I love
yeah.
Black Star.
Everybody does.
You are Black Star. No, so Black Star, the reason, like, I'm conflicted about that character because he's so damn annoying.
Yeah, I just want to punch him in the face.
I do.
Get it together, man.
Same. But on the flip side of him, his character arc And backstory is devastating and amazing.
Right.
So like watching his journey is fantastic.
Right.
Just him as the character is just.
So what makes him that way?
It's because he's so overconfident. Mm-hmm. Like he brags about himself every chance he gets, even though he's not really that good.
Right.
And so like he'll face a villain like, oh yeah, you're going down. Like you could not possibly match my power, the power of Black Star. And then he fails miserably.
And then he gets like really depressed every time he fails. Yeah. He's like, oh my God, I'm so bad at this. I'm the worst person ever. Blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay, you get to pick one. You can't have both.
Exactly. So he's just all over the place. He's right. An interesting character, but I hate him.
Yes.
And it also has Death's son, Death the Kid, mm-hmm. who is a really interesting character as well. Like he's like super OCD. And like, so he also has like two, like both of his weapons are like guns, like dual pistols.
Yep.
And like he will stop, like his OCD is so bad. Like he will stop mid battle to like adjust something.
Yeah.
And like, it's a little frustrating in that way. Is that the same character show that has the small penguin that has like the Excalibur thing?
Yes.
Okay. Yep. I thought Excalibur. So. It's been a while since I've watched it.
Excalibur's just a madman. He is just a madman.
He really is. If you haven't seen Soul Eater, I highly recommend watching Soul Eater.
It's only one season.
Yeah,
so
it's well worth it.
It's pretty easy to get through.
So I love that show. And then recently, I've been getting back into JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. Mm. Have you watched any of JoJo's?
Nope.
So I also pulled up the description for this because that show is a little hard to describe because it jumps time all the time. It jumps decades almost.
Yeah. Mm.
So it focuses on the Joestar family who are all possessed with intense psychic ability. It's the ability to will what's called Hamon. Mm. And it kind of focuses on the adventures of each member of the family throughout their lives. So it chronicles the struggles of the cursed Joestar bloodline against the forces of evil. So like the very first season is like super fast. And it focuses on the first Joestar as like, there's this whole kind of subplot, like, or main plot with like the curse of the evil, mm-hmm. is from these weird like stone masks that like once, like you put it on like it like there's like spikes that shoot at the back and like
get
into your head, and then like it basically can make you immortal and like super powerful. So the first guy who does it, basically becomes a vampire, for lack of a better way to put it. And so it kind of follows the first Joestar and like battling against him, and then it shifts. Like I'm in the second season right now, or like the second arc, mm-hmm. And it focuses on Joestar's son, who ends up like there's a whole different threat that are called like the Pillar Men, who are like these immortal beings that are also looking for ways to like amp up their own power. And so there's always these other wild side characters. The main thing with that show is that it's incredibly stylistic in terms of like the art style, like the way it's drawn, the way it's animated, the way the characters talk. Like it's all very over the top in a lot of ways, and it's very interesting. Also, a lot of the characters are named after music bands.
Oh, that's cool.
So, like, one of the Pillar Men in season two, or in the second arc, is literally named AC/DC. Mm. It's spelled differently. But, like, there's another character called REO Speedwagon. Like, it's weird and ridiculous, but it's a really fun show.
Cool. Well, what's it called again?
JoJo's Bizarre Adventure.
Cool.
This one is on Hulu, by the way.
Oh, cool.
All right. Might have to check it out sometime.
Yeah, it's wild. But I will say, like, so before we wrap up this first half of the podcast, one of the things that I personally really love about anime is not just, like, the stylistic choices, but, like, and the openings, like I mentioned before. There's something so different about the way animes are done and like the subject matter and stuff that like we don't have that in the US. And like, we're slowly like trying to make our own. Like I would say the first like US anime style was Avatar: The Last Airbender kind of anime style, which like that's a great show as well. But it's, you know, there's so many out there that deal with like, as we mentioned, like death and other subject matters that we just don't see in the US. It's just kind of unburdened that way.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate that. And like, there's some other great ones, like Gurren Lagann is really interesting. Like, probably the granddaddy of ones that people will always recommend is Neon Genesis Evangelion. And that show is a trip. Like it's just like the second half of it is just wild.
Yeah.
And like, it just,
or
it
like
deals
Sword Art, where, you know, if you want your heart ripped out, you can watch Sword Art online.
I need to watch that as well. That's on my list of things.
Yeah.
I still have to watch My Hero Academia, and I need to get back into One Punch.
No, I know we've been talking a lot about individual anime shows and stuff, and I haven't watched a ton of anime, but I am very familiar with the influences it has had on like American movies and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
With some standouts, including like the Matrix film.
The Wachowskis
was storyboarded very much like a graphic novel slash anime, and how it's depicted. And when you watch the movie, it does look like panels of a comic book.
Or
it
could be, feel it.
It could be pulled from the pages. But the Wachowskis drew a lot of inspiration from a number of different anime films, like Ghost in the Shell. And a couple of others, which I have seen, and those are great films too. And I some other films that stand out that have anime influences. Quentin Tarantino took a lot of influences
for Kill Bill.
And there's an anime sequence in that film as well. That was really good. Yeah. So there's in addition to the nods to Kung Fu films, but anime as well in that movie. And there's and one of the best anime adaptations. Well, it's not a straight adaptation, but Speed Racer was
another film that
the Wachowskis did, which was the most live action anime I think I've ever seen.
I would agree. Like it gets a lot of flack, I think, by people who watch it who weren't aware of like how stylistic the show was. And so like the live action adaptation, like it pulls straight of that style.
Right. It has.
I feel like that would have been the only way like Death Note would have been successful if they would have like stylized it heavier.
I can agree with that for sure.
Yeah. So Speed Racer was amazing, and it has all the energy that I guess I have seen Speed Racer back as a kid late at night on some cartoon or some channel. So I have seen that. So that might be the first anime I've actually seen. But Speed Racer is a really phenomenal movie that's very heavily inspired by anime. Mm-hmm. But it's too bad that people kind of don't like it because of that. Mm-hmm. But it's the artistry in that movie is so much. Like there's so much going on in that movie, and it's all inspired by anime. And it's really, so we have a lot to appreciate from anime as a whole.
Oh yeah,
even if you don't watch anime.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If you haven't, you got to watch more. Like it's something that people should wade into. But that should lead in. We'll take a quick break here in a moment, and we'll be back to talk about the actual main event of this podcast, the review of Perfect Blue. All right, we are back. Whew. All right, Perfect Blue.
Just got back from watching it.
Yeah.
We did. That was a quick hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Man, well, so general thoughts. So I guess I should say, before we get into it, I'll say what the actual plot is. So this is from 1997. It is Satoshi Kon's directorial debut, or at least as far as like a feature film.
Yeah.
So this focuses on a pop singer who gives up her career to become an actress, but she starts slowly kind of going insane or like losing her grip on reality. As she's stalked by an obsessed fan and what seems to be a ghost of her past self. Mm-hmm. Man, this film. what are your general thoughts on this movie? Before we like dig deep.
Oh man, it was excellently cut. I think like some of like the animation and like the direction that they took with it, like it was just exceptional. Like, I don't know that I've seen an animated film do some of the cutting and do some of, like, the camera movements that they, like, animated were just spectacular.
Yeah, I would have to agree. And I think some of that's probably inspired by the fact that, so this movie actually is based off of a book.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how closely it follows that book.
Apparently not
like
very.
There are certain elements that, so like Satoshi Kon, ran into problems, I think, when he was trying to adapt it and contacted the author and was basically told, you have to keep three elements of this. So you have to keep the pop style thing, you have to keep the stalker, and there's one other thing. I think it might be like the loss of grip on reality or something.
Mm-hmm.
Like there are like three elements he told him that you have to keep. Other than that, you can do what you want.
Right. Yeah, apparently he like got so into like changing the order of the script and how it went that like he couldn't really describe why the film was called Perfect Blue other than the book was called Perfect Blue and I liked the name, so I kept it.
Which makes sense.
I guess I was kind of wondering that too when I did some Google searches on it. Mm-hmm. Perfect Blue.
Right.
Blue.
Perfect.
I think from what, so there's a moment at the end where like you see a blue sky. I think that that ends up being like more meaningful in the long end, but we can talk about why that is later in the show. But so to your point about it talking almost like the camera movement, initially this film was supposed to be a live action adaptation of the book.
Okay.
And only became anime when like the backers like
they pulled out
of the thing. So like, okay, I guess we're going to do it as an anime. Cause I guess at that point it would have been cheaper.
Yeah. Probably.
Maybe at that time. So that's why it has become an anime. And I don't know if it would work the same.
Yeah.
As a live action film. I mean, it kind of does like, I don't know if you've seen Black Swan.
Yeah.
Darren Aronofsky is a huge fan of Satoshi Kon, specifically this movie. And he claims tooth and nail that this was not, that Black Swan was not influenced by this movie. It's even if it was on an unconscious level, there's too many similarities.
Well, I read that he did purchase the rights to it.
Yeah. He did. So, for Requiem for a Dream, there's a certain scene in this movie, the bathtub scene where our main character Mima is kind of sitting there and like she screams under the water. He purchased the rights for that specifically. But so I've kind of gotten off track here, but so you were saying you like the camera movement.
Yeah. Like I think, especially like the elevator scene without like giving away too much, where it, like the camera or what should be the camera, cause it's animated, like moves around the character's head to like almost reveal what's going on, but like doesn't, cause it's so like subtly animated. It's just great.
I agree with that. Devin, what do you think?
So what's interesting, so when I started watching the film, you know, I knew nothing about the story or anything or what to experience. So I was coming in pretty blind. And I have to admit, like at first, I kind of went in with that mentality of of not super invested, actually, I have to admit. But but there is a point very early in the movie that I had to kind of like sit up and it's like I realized I have to pay attention because this movie is very, it plays with reality a lot. And what from Mima's character perspective.
Yeah.
And not a couple of perspectives are happening as far as I can tell. She is a pop singer. And she has a very good career doing that, but then she wants to become an actor. But there's you have these realities of her perspective as a pop singer, and I think what her life would be without being famous, interjected with her. She goes into acting, so then she's doing she's on this television show, and then there's the reality of her being in the show as in character, and then there's the reality that there's all these realities that you have to like they keep jumping in and out of, and it kind of like watching it, you kind of are wondering what is real, what's not, did this actually happen, and and as the movie comes goes forward, there's a I wouldn't say it's a murder mystery movie, it's not that kind of setup, but this movie deals with what aggressive fans in someone who's famous and like and am I saying her name right, Mima? Is a famous person, but the way the movie depicts her is like she's also very much just a human.
She's just a normal person
who has this kind of a career, and it kind of like delves into the themes of what when fans take things too far, and so she has like this stalker person that's kind of like throughout the film that's doing these aggressive. Following her around doing these things. So there's a lot of this paranoia that's kind of building up, this suspense in that way. And there's a scene very early in the movie that I think really captures the movie as a whole. And that's when this character who's later kind of a stalker for Mima, when she's performing on stage and singing, he lifts his hand up and with his eye, he like looks at Mima in a way that like she's on his hand dancing, like on, he's putting her on his own pedestal. So she's no longer like a person to him, but she is his,
it's kind of like this avatar almost.
Right. Yeah. Avatar. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exactly. And, so that's just very interesting how this movie's dealing with fame and just being an actual person and the pressures of that. And then they throw in the stalker element and the, they, challenge what your perspective of reality is, and you have to really kind of pay attention to that kind of things. So then I had to sit up and really pay attention to this movie. And it is interesting that it was maybe going to be a live action, because the way the camera, they film a lot of this stuff, it does feel very like it could translate to live action. It felt like it just happened to be anime, but they're treating it like live action. And another point I might just mention is the way that these characters are stylized and drawn was not what I was expecting for an anime, I have to admit. I'm used to very huge expressions, and now this movie is very stylistic, but the characters are drawn very kind of like realistically as far as an anime, on anime terms.
That's actually something I was in researching the movie. So I think they very purposely made the characters look like normal people, like especially like the stalker. Like he just looks like a random guy. I mean, he doesn't like, he's not got a favorable visage, but like it looks very like a normal person would. And that was a point that they made to try and make it like more somewhat grounded, as grounded as that this movie can be.
I think I loved about it the most was like most thriller movies, because I'm into horror and thriller films, I love them, but like most of them kind of let you see behind the curtain, so you almost know what's gonna happen to the main character before it does. But this one, you're just like in the hot seat with her, like you've got no idea what's going on. You can't tell reality from not reality. You can't tell like if she's on set or if this is just a nightmare she's having, like you cannot tell until the end, like there is no peeking behind the curtain. better.
I would agree. So, like, for my own general thoughts on this movie, I would have to agree on both of your points. Like, you both make some great statements, and I agree with all of that. I will say one thing about this film that, like, I think, like, the score for this movie is absolutely haunting. So, actually, I made a point. So, I between the three of us, I'm the only one who's seen this more than once now. So, this is my second watch through. And it's one of those things, like, I knew certain things about the film because I'd seen it before, but it's been a few years. So watching it with that experience, I was trying to find like little things that would like tick off certain things. And even upon a second watch, and knowing what I do know, it's still hard to tell the difference between reality
and not
reality in this film.
Yeah.
But to the score's point of view, like that. So there's this really haunting, almost like dissonant thing every time that the Mima's ghost, for lack of a better word to put it, comes on screen, and it just makes me shudder a little bit. Just because of how it sounds.
And it's like that elevator scene again, where like you can faintly hear music happening, but you have no idea where it's coming from. And he like goes up to the elevator, and then like the music's gone. And then like it comes back, and it's like screaming loud, and then he dies. Like,
it's the use of sound in this film is well done. I feel like.
And it helps play with whether or not what you're watching is actually happening or not. That unsettling, because it's not like a typical score that has some kind of a melody or something. These are unsettling sounds that kind of play with your expectations of, or it makes you question whether or not what you're watching is actually happening or not. And so I there was several moments I'm still confused about, like not confused, but like I would choose to believe that yes, this happened and this did not. And if someone tells me otherwise, other than the creator, I don't know if I believe him or, you know, I choose to believe him.
Right. I would completely agree as well. Well, I guess we should let's go ahead and get into a deep dive on this film.
Mean spoilers?
Which does mean spoilers. You are correct. I will say we should probably preface this. There may be some there's portrayed events in this film that may be triggering, having to do with simulated and potential actual rape, that do occur in this animated film. So be prepared now to hear about that. I mean, we're not really going to go into like massive detail, but it is a topic. So please be prepared for that. So, sorry, it kind of just makes me a little. It's a touchy subject for I think a lot of people.
Well, for an anime, like not that anime is exclusive to one kind of genre or not, but this is very much a thriller that has a lot of the characters have like emotional trauma that is showcased front and center in this show, mm-hmm. and that comes in the form of the stalker character. And stalking in of itself is not cool.
Right.
And but they depict that and how that the stalker informs her mental health.
Right.
Yeah.
Early on, before it goes to before things just
start unraveling,
elevating
pretty much,
to
right?
So, so very interesting how for this movie in the way in the medium it's in, I guess.
Yeah, I would completely agree. Right. And there are things though. So, to talking about the simulator rape moment, just to kind of jump into that and talking about like the camera work,
right?
And like the cuts, the way this movie is done. That scene is kind of hard to watch in a lot of ways, because not only is that you're watching the simulated act, but like the way the camera kind of like it keeps very fast cutting, almost like one frame at a time at some point.
Yeah,
because like you see not only like her perspective and what's happening in the thing and like the lights, and there's a moment where through kind of almost through her eyes you see the people around her that are surrounding, like the characters that are surrounding her, and the lights, and it all kind of goes blurry as like she's
really like dissociating pretty much from the situation.
And it's something that this particular moment in the film, as part of her acting career, this was like a big step forward.
Right, right.
And it's not something that necessarily, like her agent certainly did not want her to do this.
No, yeah.
her agent, Rumi, is the character name.
Ran off crying
and
pretty
she actually herself was a former pop star.
Yeah.
I did not pick up on that.
Yes. I think she does mention it very briefly, or somebody does early on. And so having seen that, like, it's almost like not only is the act happening in the moment, but to Rumi, and I think almost to Mima herself, or at least to Rumi for sure, it's like this former pop persona, that persona is almost being raped.
Yeah.
And which I think is why Rumi runs off, 'cause like she can't handle like almost like that character is being like just destroyed.
So I think it'd be good to give some context what's happening there. So Mima has she's going into acting, and so she has she's on a TV show we pick up I think a little bit later.
Double Bind, I think, is what it's called.
Double Bind. And she has agent. She has her own what do you call them? Talent agent? Something. So there's two agents that she has working for her that represent her, and they are trying to look out for her best interests. And so she's on the show. She started having like just one single line. And her agents are really fighting for her to like get more lines so that she can get more exposure and develop that part of her brand. And
that was like the next thing they put her in.
And so part of what happened in the, so they're kind of deep depicting the television industry. And Mima is just kind of like, she's put in a situation that maybe she wouldn't otherwise have volunteered herself for.
Right.
But so this opportunity comes up in, was it a film in the movie? Another episode. So the episode involves her character being raped on stage. And one of the agents for sure, I think, was kind of against that
idea.
Like, Rumi was against that, but the other agent saw it as an opportunity for her to get more exposure and elevate her career a little bit. But so the movie's depicting like, you know, to get rise in your career comes at a cost. And in this case, it comes with her bodily autonomy and her own, anything related to that. So that's why she gets, because of the show, she's being put in the situation of it's a fake rape in terms of she's on a TV show,
right?
But it's still an emotionally devastating for her as a person.
Right.
So that's why we end up with her being depicted as being raped in the movie.
Thank you. And I appreciate you. I should have probably prefaced by saying that as well. And it's interesting as well. Like, obviously Rumi didn't want her to do it, but there's a moment near after that where she goes home, where Mima goes home. And cause like she agrees to the scene before and says, I accepted being an actress.
Yeah.
I'll try it.
Yeah.
And I'll see how it goes. And there's a moment where she just completely emotionally breaks down when she goes back to her little apartment and just like, obviously, of course I didn't want to do this.
Yeah.
And like, understandably feels violated and all this other stuff. And it's kind of devastating to watch, mm-hmm. honestly.
Yeah.
But we should talk probably as well about, so her former bandmates as well, like, you know, as yeah. Mima is trying to grow her own stardom as an actress, the former band, Cham, I think is what yeah. it's called.
Yep.
Like they just become a duo instead of a trio.
Yeah. And they're just super successful still.
Yeah. Like without Mima, like they,
oh man,
it's the first, they actually make a point to mention, like, it's the first time they've even made the charts.
Yeah. Without her. Mm-hmm. And like, man, that's gotta be soul crushing.
I would imagine it has to be.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and I will say, like, so you talked a little bit about one of the major themes in this film kind of being, this fandom culture. But in addition to that, like, one of the major themes as well, you mentioned the stalker, is voyeurism, which mm-hmm. I'd heard the term before, but I never actually
yeah.
had known what it meant yeah. personally. So I looked it up. So for those who don't know, according to the Cambridge Dictionary, it is the activity of getting pleasure from secretly watching other people in sexual situations, or more generally from watching other people's private lives. Mm-hmm. And that also plays a, mm-hmm. a huge role in this film, because not only in addition to that, that scene that she does, she ends up getting approached to do like photography,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
and yeah. being a model, and it ends up being mm-hmm. a lot of nude pictures,
right?
And not just nude pictures, but the photographer in that is Mima is told that he has a reputation of,
yes.
of pushing the models to
right.
get undressed. Yeah. You know, they don't start that way. That's not the agreement, maybe, but right. he has a way of like smooth talking his way
yeah.
into having them undressed, and that's not something they would maybe normally volunteer themselves to do, mm-hmm. but he is known to do that. And unfortunately right. that happens with Mima.
Right.
Yeah. And I think it's a combination of that and the role that she's in that really starts driving the stalker. Mm-hmm. And I guess, well, maybe, I don't know if I should rip the bandaid off now or not. as to like,
I've kind of been waiting, but
who, well, I'll just go ahead and say it. So Rumi, when she runs away from that earlier scene, mm-hmm. she kind of has a break in her own psyche.
Yeah.
And she ends up talking to, like, directly seeking out
the stalker
by kind of creating this persona. She ends up, her own psyche kind of sees herself as the real Mima.
Yeah.
Since she was herself a former pop idol, and trying to, like, save that image mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. of Mima. So she kind of herself becomes Mima and reaches out to him and starts saying that, like, This Mima that you're seeing now is not the real one.
And it's, she's yeah. reaching out to her by...
Yes. So using... there is this fan page.
Right.
This is like 1997, so it's early days of internet.
Right.
This kind of fan page called Mima's Room. But she also like directly emails him, I believe.
Yes.
As well.
Uh-huh.
Through this. And so basically... And he... he takes it as fact
because mm-hmm.
he's so engrossed in this persona.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing the actual real Mima... had this drastic shift in her, you know, it's mm-hmm. no, her persona is no longer, you know, Mima, the pop idol. It's the actor, you
right.
know. And so, like, she basically tells him to get rid of the real Mima.
Mm-hmm.
So he starts showing up. I mean, he's everywhere in general.
Yeah.
But he's the one, so you mentioned the guy in the elevator dying.
Yeah, yep.
So one of the main things about the murders that happened in this film, they're very gruesome.
Mm-hmm. But they were all like technically motivated to protect Mima in
true,
a way.
True. I will agree with that.
Right.
But they're all performing like using an ice pick basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is very, I don't recall when Fatal Attraction came out. But that
I'm,
is very
I'm
Fatal
just
Attraction.
I'll wildly guess and say 1990.
I think it was during the 90s for sure.
Yeah.
Early 90s, I'd say. Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if that choice was inspired by that. I didn't look that up, but mm-hmm. it is interesting that that was the weapon of choice.
Right. I remember halfway through the week I was talking to Tim and I was like, yeah, I watched like the first half of the movie, which I think I stopped like right around when she got back to her apartment and her fish were dead.
Ah.
And, and that's where I had kind of cut it off. And I told Tim with like full confidence, I was like, the stalker scary looking dude is not the main evil mm-hmm. in this movie. I definitely knew it was Rumi at that point just because like the one time that she comes into her bedroom and she's like, oh yeah, this is how you get on the internet and this is how you get
yeah.
into this website and this is how you do all of this. And she was like, wow, that person knows everything about me. And it just like clicked. I was like, oh man, who knows everything about her if not Rumi?
Good for you. I didn't like, put that together until it was like super obvious.
Right. Like I had that gut feeling, but but then like the rest of the film made me like second guess myself the whole time.
Yeah.
Just from the way it was cut.
The first time I watched this movie, I don't think I picked on a button either.
Right.
And that's like an experience. Film watcher like looking out for tropes a lot of the times. Like yeah. I didn't catch that either. And yeah. I think it's because of that reality shift mm-hmm. that happens constantly.
Uh-huh.
Yep. That like you don't know.
Like I was so certain and then I just like started watching the second half of it and I was like, I don't know if I'm certain anymore. Mm-hmm. It just kind of yanks the rug out from
just
underneath
you. Just want to throw out there that Fatal Attraction came out in 1987. So.
Oh, so a full decade before this.
Wow.
Well, and Basic Instinct is the one that has the ice.
Oh, pick. Is it? Oh, okay, my bad.
And that came out in 1992.
Oh, okay. So my bad.
So just a little bit before.
They're both. Isn't Glenn Close in both of those?
No. Sharon Stone is in Basic Instinct.
Oh, that's right.
That's the one of the famous.
The ice pick thing.
Well, sure. Sure, Tim. That, it does have the ice pick scene, but it also has Sharon Stone with no bottom
right,
clothes.
The leg crossing.
Yes,
scene.
Leg crossing. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, one of the most apparently with paused
a,
moments in
with
all
with a very thirsty Wayne Knight
yeah.
looking on. Yeah. But yeah, you're right. Glenn Close is in Fatal Attraction.
Okay,
with both have Michael Douglas in it.
That's probably why I'm confusing them.
The original Ant-Man. So
he is indeed. So in talking about this, the fact that Rumi ends up being the main one that so mm-hmm. we do discover that at the very end of the film.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah,
as there's a moment where the stalker actually comes and tries to not only kill Mima.
Yeah,
but he almost tries to also rape her, it seems like.
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah.
And she manages to get away. Like she does a hammer to his head.
Yeah.
She ends up coming across Rumi, or Rumi finds mm-hmm. her, and somehow the body is gone.
Right.
Which makes me wonder if somebody else, like if Rumi managed to move it before that or not.
I think Rumi
like,
kills him in the end.
Oh, I guess she does. Yeah.
So.
And Rumi is also like gaslighting Mima.
Yeah. Yeah.
During this movie. Near the end of the movie, Mima passes out
mm-hmm.
and Rumi takes her back to her apartment, which is scarily close to Mima's apartment.
Surprise.
Down to the fish tank and the poster of Cham on the wall.
Yeah.
And Rumi happens to look out, Mima wakes up and happens to look out the window and discovers it's not her apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when Rumi comes in dressed in a different outfit.
Yeah.
And basically claims, I'm the real Mima.
Right.
And I'm going to kill you, basically.
Yeah.
And it goes down this really interesting and scary scene where she's chasing after her, trying to kill her.
Yeah.
She ends up jumping off of the fire escape. And
yeah. She's like dedication.
That's a way to look at it. pardon me. It's really interesting. So in this whole time, so Mima sees, flashback between her seeing a ghost of herself, in reflections and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think I saw somewhere that anytime you see this other version of Mima, out
in public,
it's actually Rumi. Her, actually Rumi.
Horrifying.
And it's really interesting that they play with your own perspective as this is happening, because even during that chase where mm-hmm. that's happening, there's a moment where the entire time, in reality, you see this fictional version of Mima who's hopping and mm-hmm. almost without gravity, floating around and jumping. And then in a reflection, you see Rumi with a mask in a window.
Yeah,
that's
just running
the hell as far as
horrifying.
Yeah.
This will be a really interesting movie to have a second watch on then. Cause once you know it's Rumi at the end,
you start looking for those signs.
Yeah, you want to look for the...
Like I was saying, the only peek behind the curtain you get is, you get to watch the murders happen.
Yeah.
So, you think it is also Mima. So you're, riding in that hot seat with Mima, and you're like, holy crap, am I the one who's killing all of these people? Mm-hmm.
Well, especially when she finds the bloody shirt and stuff in her closet.
Uh-huh.
As well. So, she was almost being set up for that as well. And it's just... So, at the very end of this film... after this chase, Rumi sees she tries to hit Mima and she breaks the glass or a giant mirror or something, and loses the wig that she's wearing, which for herself completely breaks her.
Yeah.
In a moment, saying it's kind of like when in Watchmen when Rorschach loses his mask.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where's my face? It's kind of similar to that to me, where she gets the wig and she, completely devoid of thinking critically, she bends down to get the wig and impales herself on the glass. And then they end up, she like ends up going out into the road and seeing these headlights come towards her, which she sees in her mind as like almost this moment of clarity, like she's in front of a crowd.
Right.
Yeah.
Crowd, fans. Yeah. Spotlights.
And then Mima does make an interesting choice mm-hmm. despite what's happening right. to try and save Rumi
yep.
from being run over.
Yep.
Which I thought was I was looking forward to a splat, but I was denied that.
I know.
You sadistic person.
I know. Well, I mean, after you've killed so many Rumi people.
Rumi was sadistic at that point, so.
Interestingly, she makes that choice, and so they both do survive. Mm-hmm. Rumi ends up being put in a mental institution, and Mima ends up kind of, like, this nightmare is kind of ending for her. She's no longer... questioning her reality and herself and her actions. And Rumi is still like, they make a moment to mention that she does occasionally revert back to Rumi.
Mm-hmm.
But she's so fractured at this point that she still believes she's Mima.
Yeah.
And the film basically ends with Mima sitting in her car, like on this nice sunny day where the sky is kind of perfect and everything. And she looks in the mirror and says, yeah, this is me. I am real. Like I know what is real.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is it's very cathartic.
Yeah. As an ending. It's such a big flip because like the whole movie, like the whole hour some runtime is like really dark and full of red and full of like scary deep colors, and then the only time you get that bright, nice color is at the end.
It really is.
Right.
This movie I think is really impressive.
And that's a really good point about color too.
Yeah.
Shikashi Kohan uses reds like color has a very specific purpose and what it's trying to make you feel and portray on screen, and so that really did stand out to me a lot. And I was wondering if you caught this, Tim, but at the end of the movie when Mima's in her car and she looks in the mirror and she says her line of "it's the real me," did you catch that that's actually not her voice? So apparently, and I had to look it up to just see if I was going crazy or not, but that's actually the voice actor who does Rumi saying that line.
Oh, my God.
Really?
Yeah. So
is it the real her?
So what that means, I could mean, I think that's Shikashi Kohan just adding a little bit more.
Oh, man.
Mystique to the whole
thing. Oh my gosh. I did not know that. That completely skews my perspective now.
Right.
Because I'm choosing to believe that that is the real Mima. But the fact that it's Rumi's voice actor saying that line now just kind of like adds another layer.
Did she trap Mima in the mental institution and escape?
I chose to believe that it was the real Mima as well. That blows my mind.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And I'm surprised I caught it because, like, I'm watched an English dub version. So,
oh, you found a dub?
Okay.
Where'd you find the dub?
I subscribed to Shudder.
Well, that's what I was watching it on. I thought I only had...
When I say a dub, I don't mean English voiceover. Mm-hmm. I mean it's...
Oh, the sub.
There was subtitles.
The
sub. Yeah.
Okay.
So it was... Yeah, there was subtitles with English. So what I'm hearing is the original Japanese audio.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. That's what I was watching. I was watching the subbed version.
So I'm kind of like surprised I caught the difference there.
Wow. Maybe it was because it was so late at night, which interestingly, I chose to watch this with the lights out to see if it would enhance.
I watched it at night.
I think it does enhance the experience.
Yeah.
So I guess we should, as we're wrapping up the podcast. So we have developed a new ranking system for this. And it is going from Avoid being the very obviously like we wouldn't recommend it to meh to solid, which is like it's a solid movie. It's it's neither great nor bad. It's just it's very in the middle to great, and then finally to superb.
Mm-hmm.
So Amber, what would you rate this movie at?
Oh man, I'm going superb.
Oh wow,
easily.
Reasons?
Just because it keeps you behind the curtain. It's very non-traditional thriller. You've got no idea what's going on, where the cuts are just so quick and like disorienting that it like kind of keeps you on your toes, and that the big reveal, even something that I thought I had caught on to, wasn't quite right. I think it was really good. It was very unexpected.
Excellent. Devin?
I probably, for the most of it, I would probably rate it great. Because of how it was stylized. But the, the ending kind of just, like, I liked how it took the theme all the way home, even in the last moment that...
Like the toxic fandom culture kind of thing.
Well, with Rumi's voice actor doing that. So, the, like, what's real and not, like, it's all, I don't even, maybe the movie isn't even real. I don't know what I watched. So, I'd probably say it's superb. This is a good film that I think has, makes you think a lot and has a lot to talk about and deconstruct here that happened. So it, because at the beginning I was just kind of casually watching it, but then the very early in the movie, like 5 minute mark, I was like, I had to lean in, like really pay attention, like, and like, no, this needs all my focus, and in a good way. Like I had to pay attention to the details because they really matter and play with your expectations. So I think this is a superb film. I like the art direction too, and because I also came in expecting a certain kind of way stylistically with being an anime, but I think the way the characters are drawn really complement the themes of the story and stuff. And so there's just a lot of neat camera things going on in the way this movie is constructed. So I think it's a really superb film.
Excellent. I think for myself, I'm going to have to also put it in superb. I on initial viewing, like, as I was really starting to rewatch the movie, I was feeling just great because, like, having known the things that I knew already, I felt like that was, to a certain degree, taking certain things away from me. But now that you've mentioned that ending thing where the, like, the voice actors changed, I mean, not just that, but, like, other things, from not just the art direction, the music, and the fact that it's, like, especially nowadays with, like, the toxic fandom and, like, being, like, the internet being such a pervasive thing in our lives. Like, I was watching a video that talked about this where, you know, all of us to a certain degree are now both audience and performer by having, like, followers on Facebook or Instagram or whatever. Like, we have kind of our own crafted online persona that is what we put out there. And then we have the real us. And so I think just, like, that theme in particular, I think is still relevant. Especially even now, today. I think this film is superb. I think it's a must see. If you haven't seen it, I think you should watch it. And it, it's one of those films that I think, unfortunately, it's kind of been not swept under the rug, but kind of forgotten about. It seems like
I didn't even know it existed.
I didn't until a few years ago either. And it, that's such a shame. So I think it needs to be more noticed and more watched. So I would say superb myself.
Awesome.
All right, well, I think that's all we have time for today on Nerds Now Playing. We will be back with you next week for another film review. And until then, play on, nerds.